the business. You ever notice that? Drew Bill Ewan, tremendous Keith Williams.
What Keith?
Because if I do, I find myself going to sleep. So I gotta be like, ooh.
I have the same problem if you listen to any of these.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm used to having a bell ring in the lectures, but since we don't have one here, we'll start at the hour. Welcome to your session. You made it your session by coming here, of the WESCON technical sessions, session number 22, which is called Intelligence and Instrumentation. Now, I noticed that in the spectrum, if you had a chance to look at that, they entitled us under the category of smart meters. Well, I sort of take exception to that, but I hope that this will convey more than just the topic of smart meters. There are a few details which I would like to discuss first. As you walked in the door, you were handed two things. One was a question form, and I would appreciate if you could write down your questions as they arise during the talk, and then have the room coordinator pick them up and submit them to me. The reason for doing it this way is the following. I was asked by the IEEE educational group to give them permission to record the session for their educational tapes. And there's no microphone in the room, so I will have to read the questions so they will get properly on tape. The second thing that you picked up coming in is a critique sheet. Now, this is almost like an end-of-course questionnaire, and I would appreciate if you fill in all the points that you feel are appropriate for this, because it is that kind of a feedback that can make the next session better. We have to rely on this feedback. And for those of you who are teachers, you know that when you walk into a class at 8 o'clock in the morning, you sort of scan the faces and you try and get feedback from the faces, but it usually doesn't work too well at 8 in the morning, I've found. So the second thing you rely on for feedback is questions. So please get those questions on the paper. And the other things now will be dealing with the session itself. I considered a challenge, and I've done this before a couple of times, to organize a session at WESCON for several reasons. One, first of all, I learned something in the process, and I feel as a teacher you have to keep up with the developments. And number two, the other challenge which I always consider this to be, is to try and get people from industry to talk about interesting developments without making it sound like a commercial or propaganda lecture for the companies. And that, I found, is the most difficult thing. So I would like to point out right at the beginning, if anyone in this group here in the audience feels that one of the speakers is giving a commercial pitch, then let's forgive him and chalk it up to the enthusiasm that he has for the development of the product. The next thing I would like to do is to point out to you that the first session here in the morning is only one of two. In my naivete, I proposed two sessions, hoping that one would be accepted, and they accepted both of them. So the session in the afternoon deals with the topic of calculator-based systems, and I suggest that if you find the morning session interesting enough that would warrant your coming back, that you join us again at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. This is session number 27. So now, without taking some thunder out of the talks that you will hear, and of course you all have seen the preprints, or may have had a chance to look at the preprints, number 22, let me point out one thing here. The paper numbering was 22/1, and then there was one skipped, and then 3 and 4. Well, the one paper that was skipped for the reason that it didn't quite make it to the printing deadline. But it is going to be a paper presented by Richard H. Blackwell of Dumont Oscilloscope Labs, and I will introduce it at the time. So the second paper that you hear is not contained in your preprint. Our first speaker this morning is Francais Rodet. He received his diploma engineering degree at Ljubljana University in Yugoslavia in 1960. He came to the States then and got a master's degree from Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois in 1962. He joined Hewlett-Packard in 1962, has been with them ever since, and is at the present time a project leader of Hewlett-Packard Electronics Research Laboratories. Some of you may already know his contribution to the development of the HP 35. So he has a very strong background in the area of intelligent instrumentation, and not just the instrumentation end of it, but also the intelligence end of it. So without any further ado, I would like to introduce Francais Rodet with his first presentation.
The central processor unit as integral part of instrument is the topic which I would like to talk about. For advancements in semiconductors are providing new building blocks to the instrument designers. Shift registers, counters, read-only memories, even complete central processor unit can be built on a single chip. These elements are digitally oriented and thus do point to a more digital approach in designing instruments. If input signal is digitized right at the start and then numerically processed, design of complex analog circuits could be avoided. This is especially true if you have to produce a numeric answer. A simple processor integrated into the instrument could provide a more powerful instrument, can add flexibility to the instrument, and also can give solutions to measurements which will not be possible without some numerical process of data. To illustrate my point, I wish to give a few examples. First slide, please. Here we are talking about the time interval measurement. If you want to measure the time interval from start to stop by a conventional method, you have to count time base, in our case, 10 megahertz, directly into a counter, and that will give you a plus minus one count ambiguity, which is inherited in every counter. For the 10 megahertz time base, one could resolve the time to 100 nanoseconds. Higher frequency time base could be used, and that way the resolution can be improved. But there is a question how high one can count directly with a counter. For 100 picosecond resolution, a 10 gigahertz time base should be used. And we know that today we cannot count directly 10 megahertz. I will show you that that kind of measurement can be done if you employ some arithmetic process to help you do that. The time interval from start to stop is equal to T0 plus T1 minus T2. Now, if we can measure these incremental times and then numerically or mathematically process them, we will have improved the resolution to the point how good we can resolve these three times. T0 is the time from first clock pulse after start to the next to the next clock pulse after stop. This time is measured very accurately because we do simply count the number of clock pulses. And the accuracy of that will be dependent only on the accuracy of the clock time base, which can be made quite accurate. A harder problem is to measure the T1 and T2, which are less than one cycle of your time base. This is done by help of an interpolator. During the time from start to the first clock pulse, which corresponds to T1, one can charge a capacitor. That capacitor with a constant current. That capacitor is then discharged with 1,000 times smaller current. That means we expanded the time by 1,000. And during the discharge time, one can then count the 10 megahertz clock and thus resolve that time, T1, to 100 picoseconds. The same is done on the time T2. Time T2 is equal now to the sum of these counts which we counted. N0 corresponding to T0 plus N1 over 1,000 corresponding to T1 minus N2 over 1,000. All is multiplied by 100 nanoseconds because we did do our counting with 10 megahertz time base. By rearranging this equation, we see that the time is resolved to 100 picoseconds. To solve this equation mathematically, you have to have a unit which is able to add, subtract, and multiply. But if we have that and do solve this equation mathematically, we will resolve the time to 100 picosecond resolution. Black diagram on the slide shows a simplified sketch of that kind of instrument. The input signal is counted in counting registers. Then the incremental times are transferred to central processing unit, which is controlled by read-only memory. Read-only memory contains the algorithm which tells us how we manipulate these numbers. The algorithm can also have some steps in it which will rearrange our answer to be displayed in the most desirable form. Basic time base has to be in the any counter, and the same one is also used to provide a timing for the RAM and central processing unit. Here we have the multiple period measurement. The multiple period is measured by changing it to a time interval measurement. If we select one of the positive transitions of input signal as a start and measure the time T to the stop point, which is also one of the transitions of the input signal, and by help of the previous algorithm, we measure T, and at the same time, we do count the number of periods, Nx, we will accumulate four numbers which have to be processed mathematically. N0, N1, and N2 are corresponding to time interval measurement, and Nx is the number of periods we measured. Here we have the expression for the period, which is equal to time divided by number of events. If we replace in the equation the result of previous time interval measurement, we see that we can measure periods to 100 picoseconds. Frequency measurement is the same, except the division is going to be done in reverse, namely nx divided by t. To do this, we have to add only one more instruction to the repertoire of instructions we had before, that is division. This method for measuring time interval, period, and frequency was incorporated in Hewlett-Packard 5360 computing counter. After a decision was made, or is made, to incorporate arithmetic power into the instrument itself, the most important question is what kind of instruction set one needs to operate the instrument properly. With proper selection of instruction set, one can really gain a lot of flexibility for very small incremental cost of the instrument. Basically, one could divide the instruction set in five groups. First will be arithmetic instructions, add, subtract, multiply, transfers, which means rearranging the data within the registers, like copy and clear, interchange. Output, you want to display your information on the command, maybe print or store. Input, count, digit entry. Okay, I call that instruction count, but you can call it whatever you want to. What is important for that instruction is that gives you possibility to start the measurement on the command. It's maybe interrupt or whatever. And the fifth group are subroutines. As you saw, the time interval measurement was used in period and frequency measurement. Therefore, instead of repeating the steps, you form a subroutine which you can call by one instruction. And similar instruction is square root. So a powerful instruction set can really add to the flexibility of the instrument. Here I'm showing the 5360 computing counter, but I'm bringing up only to point that there is a, down on the left corner is a selector switch. And that selector switch can make the computing capability of the instrument's mainframe available to different areas, to the input module, which is the first middle section, plug-in, and there is also a connector on the in the back called external. With that switch, one can select where the control for the central processor unit built within the instrument will come from. With this flexibility, the plugin designer, for example, will have much easier task because he can utilize the power within the instrument. Here I'm showing the phase measurement and what has to be done in this particular case to use to build a plugin. To measure the phase, one has to measure period of the input signal, the time delay between the two signals, and then solve the equation for the phase, multiply that by 360, and you will have the answer in degrees. Now, when one wants to design a plugin for this counter, sure, he has to make input circuitry, and that is not an easy task when we are talking about 100 picosecond time measurements. But after the input stage is done, then the only thing what he has to do is solve that equation, and that is done by a small RAM in put into the plugin, which is going to call for two time measurements, a divide and a multiply, and the answer can be displayed in degrees. Let's say this was done sometimes in the past, where we didn't have a small CPUs. That's why we had to have that big counter. But now I would like to refer myself to a family of instruments which one can build around small central processor unit. This family of instruments is the one which will make a linearization of a transducer. A transducer like strain gauge or thermocouple will produce an output proportional to the pressure or temperature or whatever physical quantity is being measured. This relationship in general is not linear, and to linearize it, a small central processor can be used. For example, the power of a central processor within Hewlett-Packard 35 pocket calculator is sufficient to do the algorithm I'm going to describe. On the diagram, we have the input signal comes to the transducer. The output of transducer is digitized in count shift element, and then together with a stored constant under the control of the read-only memory, which contains the algorithm, transferred to the CPU and then processed. The data is then displayed in proper units, and that can be done with very small addition in the steps in the algorithm. Here we have the transfer function of transducer input to the output. If we expand this function with binomial expansion and choose the coefficients properly, we can assure the linear transfer function. With about 7 coefficients, one can linearize almost any transducer. Now, to solve this equation, one has to have the capability of multiplying and adding. So you start x times n cn plus cn minus 1, multiply that by x. If this algorithm is stored in a RAM, then only by changing the coefficients, one could make this instrument be able to do linearization of different transducers. The flow diagram shows the basic steps which have to be stored in the RAM. First, we start the measurement, then we digitize the transducer output, read that digitized number into the central processor unit together with setting the counter of the loop and start reading the coefficients. Now we enter on the top the loop, which has a multiply, the unknown times the highest order coefficient, decrement the loop counter, and add the next factor. We repeat that till the loop counter is zero, and at that point we have the linear answer with to be displayed. And the new measurement can be started again. I would like to point out again that by implementing this algorithm with incorporation of a small central processor unit, you could make an instrument to whom you could change the transducers, and by just simply changing its coefficients. And these coefficients can you can compute, or you can get them empirically. There are many other areas where we could talk about employing some computing power in the instrument. I mean, to build it within the instrument. But I would like you to start thinking in this direction and explore the potentials that are given to you with large-scale integrated circuit when you are designing new instruments.
Thank you very much, Francais. Before we proceed with our session here, those standing in the back, there's some room up here if you would like to switch places or come up here. There's room up here in the front. You know, this whole topic of intelligence and instrumentation is really a fascinating one. The first problem, of course, that comes up is to define what is intelligence. And you can look it up in the Webster Dictionary, but you only get the non-technical explanation of what intelligence is. And I've tried to come up with some feasible story that might explain what intelligence is all about, because it's not just the knowledge of facts. It's also the way you put them together in different situations in a different way. And in a way, I'm reminded of a story that I heard some time ago where the two workmen digging a ditch and the supervisor standing up there watching it get to talking. And he says, well, how come, Joe, that we have to do all the digging down here while he's standing up there and doing nothing? He said, I don't know. Go up and ask him. So he goes up and says, well, how come that you're standing up here and we have to work down there sweating and you're just enjoying life? He says, well, it's a difference of intelligence. He says, well, how come? Well, look here. Here's my hand. I want you to hit it as hard as you can. And he held it up against the wall. And so sure enough, he hits it, and in the proper moment, he pulls it back. And of course, the poor guy learns a very painful lesson in intelligence, because he knew exactly when to pull the hand back and to put it there in the first place. So with that knowledge, he goes down and tells, well, now I know what intelligence is. He says, well, how do you know? Well, look, here's my hand. I don't have to continue the story. I did also fail to point out at the beginning how the organization of this particular session is. We intend to present four papers, about 20 minutes each. And if there are any questions that you would like to direct to a specific speaker, you can write them on this piece of paper you have. And if there are any now, I would ask the room attendant to collect them for me. Are there any questions? Maybe can a show of hands? Okay, you can still keep them or present them to us at the end of the four paper presentations. At that point, we will have a break and then reconvene for a panel discussion. This is really the chance that you get to get questions answered in this field of intelligence and instrumentation. Maybe we should ask one of them to define intelligence. So, our next speaker, as I pointed out before, does not have his paper in the preprint. I'm sure that if you would like to get a copy of this, that it can be arranged by talking to the speaker. The speaker is Richard H. Blackwell from the Dumont Oscilloscope Laboratories. He got his bachelor degree in engineering, electrical engineering, from North Carolina State University in 1962, and his master's in electrical engineering at Newark College of Engineering in 1969. He worked for Hewlett-Packard from 1962 to 1968 as a development engineer, and joined Dumont in 1968 and has been there ever since. At the moment, he is the engineering manager. One second. The title of the paper he is going to present to us is the automatic oscilloscope. And so without any further ado, I would like to introduce Dick Blackwell.
Thank you, Professor Penholzer. As you will hear about today, the capabilities of many measurement type instruments have been enhanced with the application of programming, data processing, and computational methods. And the well-established measurement capabilities of the oscilloscope, which include rise time, pulse width, timing, peak-to-peak amplitude, and so on and so forth, can also benefit from these techniques. There are two basic areas in which a mini computer, for example, can be used to improve the measurement process. One is in the programming function, that is, programming the various functions, controls, and parameters of an instrument, and the other is in analyzing and processing the results of the measurements. Programming the oscilloscope differs from programming DVMs, frequency counters, and other instruments only in the variety and number of controls that must be programmed. Now, of course, the number of controls programmed can be reduced, which reduces cost and complexity, but it also limits the measurement capability. If the total flexibility of the manual oscilloscope is to be retained, then all of the common control features and functions of the bench-type oscilloscope must be maintained and programmed. Once this decision is made, one is faced with programming approximately 30 independent control functions or parameters, and many of these have multiple settings. These parameters consist of functions such as display functions, channel 1, 2, alternate, that sort of thing. Ranges, such as time-based ranges or vertical attenuator settings, and levels, for example, position, trigger level, hold-off, and so forth. The programming functions and ranges are controlled by relays or by logic gates, and the levels are provided by D to A converters. In the particular programmable oscilloscope that has been built at Dumont, we wind up with 128 parallel programming lines to control 30 functions. These lines are grouped by independent function and coded for maximum bit density within the groups. And these programmable controls include the attenuator settings, position settings, coupling, display functions, time bases, trigger levels, sources, in other words, all of the controls that are found on the familiar oscilloscope. The programmable oscilloscope itself provides for the use of directive type intelligence from a CPU, a mini computer, or whatever. For example, in using this type of technique, a prearranged test procedure for a circuit module, for example, can be stored in the memory and output to the oscilloscope as a series of steps. Now, this accomplishes two things. One, it forces the human operator to follow a prescribed procedure in testing the module. And secondly, it greatly speeds up the process because the maximum time required to change all of the control settings of the oscilloscope under program control is about 200 milliseconds. Which is faster than a human operator can adjust maybe even one control on a conventional panel. Thus, the operator is freed from the burden of adjusting controls and following charts of control settings and can devote all of his time to analyzing the results of the measurement. So, in this case, we're improving the use of human intelligence. Now, although the programmable oscilloscope by itself is a useful tool, the results can be greatly enhanced, and many other possibilities arise if we are able to return from the oscilloscope digitized data representing the information that appears on the CRT. This data acquisition and conversion is accomplished with a sample and hold type circuit combined with an A to D converter. At this point, we're faced with several problems as to the arrangement of the A to D system, and which in turn has a direct bearing on the operation of the oscilloscope. If the data acquisition system is of the real-time type, then of course the bandwidth is going to be limited by the conversion time of our A to D converter system. Now, this limitation can be avoided if the A to D converter is synchronized to the input signal and variable time delay is introduced, similar to what is done in a sampling type oscilloscope. In this case, we lose the real-time information. By combining both of these techniques, we can attempt to optimize the usefulness of the data that's returned from the oscilloscope. For high-frequency signals, which exceed the ability of the A to D system to keep up in real time, we can go to a technique similar to that in the sampling scope. For low-frequency signals, where we may want the continuous real-time data stream, then the sampler can be operated in that mode. The trigger generator and time-based circuits of the oscilloscope are a convenient source of the various synchronizing and start-stop signals necessary to control this sort of A to D system. The delayed pulse for operating the sampler in the sampling mode is easily provided, and a data valid type signal for a real-time converter system is also available. The digital data that is returned by the A to D converter from the oscilloscope to the mini computer consists of XY coordinate values in time delay and amplitude, or in relative time and amplitude. In this particular system, the number of coordinate pairs taken and the conditions under which they are taken are completely under program control. Up to 1,000 discrete X locations across the CRT may be used, and in the case of the Y axis points, a 10-bit A to D converter is used. The computational processing that is then applied to this data is limited really only by the computer itself. Simple measurements such as peak-to-peak amplitude or time delay or time difference requires minimal effort on the part of the computer. If transform or statistical methods are needed, then of course more elaborate algorithms and more elaborate software will be necessary. One of the most interesting aspects of this capability in terms of intelligence is the use of a computational result to modify the programmable control settings. This in effect closes the loop. A simple example of this, which I might describe to you, is amplitude auto-ranging. In this case, the peak-to-peak amplitude information, which is returned to the CPU, can be used to determine up-ranging or down-ranging information for vertical attenuators and position control to recenter the display if it should happen to be off-center. This requires only very simple algorithms. Thus, the oscilloscope automatically can adjust its vertical attenuators and position controls to keep a display centered and of a convenient size. This procedure also serves to center the signal in the dynamic range window of the A to D converter system, and therefore it's a useful routine to include in certain types of pre-programmed troubleshooting routines. I want to point out here that this type of auto-ranging function is software generated, and therefore it is not a true hardware function of the oscilloscope, but it is a pseudo function. It is quite unlike the hardware auto-ranging of a DVM, for example, because all of the auto-ranging criteria is defined in software and accomplished by programming the controls of the oscilloscope to in effect simulate auto-ranging. Many other pseudo-functions may also be created using this technique, For example, to adjust the time base for a specific number of zero crossings across the display, or for a specific number of peaks or other features of the waveform that can be analyzed by the computer. These functions may be for the benefit of a human interpreter, or they may be for data normalizing process, such as centering the signal in the dynamic range window. In either case, whatever the reason is that this is being used, the technique for accomplishing it is the same. Now, of course, there are some types of input signals which do not lend themselves to this sort of technique. Impulsive signals, noise bursts, and certain other types cannot be effectively auto-ranged. But there are other techniques that can be applied, and this is the single greatest advantage of controlling only the basic operating parameters in hardware and generating elaborate functions in software. The disadvantage of this technique, of course, is the large software overhead that's required. And for this reason, software is an important consideration in a system of this type. It is desirable, from the user's point of view, to be able to program an instrument directly from a high-level language, rather than having to write specialized assembly language for each application. And this is especially true in the system such as I am describing here, when computational routines need to be interwoven with instrument command routines with great flexibility. The routines that I've just been discussing, the auto-ranging and automatic zero-crossing adjust and so forth, have all been implemented using a modified Fortran interactive compiler. The modification provides for literal and numerical commands to be passed via Fortran write statements or read statements to the programmable oscilloscope, a function linkage program added to the compiler handles the decoding and formatting that's required for this function. Numerical arguments are passed directly into and out of the Fortran variable table, and the literal arguments are handled separately. This allows mnemonics to be generated, which correspond to the markings on ordinary oscilloscope front panels. And it also allows numerical arguments generated within the program to be passed directly to control range or position, for example. Thus, the oscilloscope command statements can be freely intermingled with ordinary Fortran statements, so long as syntax rules are obeyed. And the mnemonics can be easily memorized or recognized directly because of their relationship to well-known control nomenclature. The interactive compiler, of course, provides for online modification and experimentation. This particular arrangement maximizes convenience and ease of program, but it doesn't conserve memory size. Of course, to maximize the effective size of the memory requires software tailored for a specific application. The exact trade-off between convenience and cost, of course, must be decided depending on the application itself. I have a slide here, if I could have number one, to show the physical arrangement of the programmable oscilloscope. This upper unit here is the actual programmable oscilloscope itself. You'll notice the absence of controls, which are not needed except for brightness and focus. And the second unit down is an interactive controller for use with the mini computer. And this panel right here is a manual control panel, which includes the controls usually found on an oscilloscope. This allows us to combine fully automatic operation or manual operation or combinations of the two to enhance the flexibility and interaction with human operators. The fully programmable oscilloscope with data acquisition capability provides several levels of instrument intelligence. Since the oscilloscope is used to make many different kinds of measurements and is a relatively complex instrument to operate properly, computer-directed control settings can reduce errors, save time, and enhance the operator's analysis of data. Returning measured results to the computer for mathematical reduction or processing permits even more detailed analysis, with resulting improvements in speed, accuracy, and general capability. And closing the loop completely by using the processing results to modify control settings, in many cases, can eliminate the need for an operator entirely.